From the Sunrise Coast to the Sunset Coast, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear from Republican gubernatorial candidate Bill Schuette on low literacy scores of students and what he thinks can be done.
This is all about having a culture of reading in Michigan, and when I'm governor, Michigan's children will read.
New research on how where you live affects your health.
Access to healthy foods, exposure to crime, exposure to industrial contamination.
Deans at Michigan State University are working toward changing the culture of the university.
To begin to have the kinds of conversations that will ensure that when people speak up, they're listened to.
And we talk to the latest artisan of Michigan.
I feel like I'm doing a weekend fun hobby every day. Every day feels like a Saturday to me. I love what I do.
Plus Ken Sikkema and Vicki Barnett and a look at Michigan politics. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Between now and Election Day, we're having conversations with statewide candidates about a single issue. And today that issue is the recent report that literacy scores of Michigan school children have declined again. Today's guest is the Republican candidate for governor, Bill Schuette. You heard the M-STEP results this week. Only 44% of kids from third grade to eighth grade in the state reached proficiency in the literacy portion of the test. That means more than half failed. This ties into something you've been talking about on the campaign trail, and that's getting third grade reading scores up. So how would you make that happen?
Well, you know, we should be up in arms, and it's outrageous that our third grade reading scores, which means to our listening audience in terms of how well can you read, what's the proficiency ability, and across the state of Michigan, these latest scores are just unfortunately tragically low. It means that the current approach is failing, and you know, I believe that every child is born with a sense of wonder, and this country and this state should be a shining city on a hill. But if you can't read the directions to get there, or if you can't spell opportunity, well you're the prism through which you see Michigan and this country is pretty dim and gloomy. So what I want to do is grade our schools A through F. I want to provide grants for those schools that are showing improvement. I support incentives. I'll have a literacy director, Lester, in the governor's office because of the significance of this issue of reading, and establish a Michigan Reading Foundation so that the philanthropic community, the business community, we can fund summer reading camps, reading coaches, transportation scholarships if you need to get to a different school and you can't get there. Or let's just say you have a child with a special needs, but there's a school with a special program, but the cost of transportation is a barrier to getting there. Well, transportation scholarships would help. So this is all about having a culture of reading in Michigan. And when I'm governor, Michigan's children will read.
You just touched on rewarding high-performing schools. And you also have said in past interviews, giving struggling schools the support they need to become more successful. What kind of support would that be?
Well, you know, that's all it goes right back to this fundamental core issue, and Lester, and that is reading coaches and summer reading camps to try to help those students and their parents in terms of this culture of reading. And that's really the my Grow Reading Plan, which means great readers on the way, is all about this culture of reading. And it's also bridges this issue of apprenticeships and skilled trades that our schools and our high schools need to make sure that we provide choices and options for a high school graduate. Maybe that person is going to go to college, but maybe that person has the agility and the brains to be a top-notch a person in the skilled trade. So apprenticeship programs like we see with DTE and Randolph High School and Henry Ford College, kind of having a marriage of training, mentoring, tutoring, and there's the Mid-Michigan Construction Academy in the Midland area that works with skilled trades as well. So we have to have options and choices, and parents need to be in charge of all this education approach. And my Democrat opponents, they just, the Whitmer-Gilchrist team, it's just embracing the status quo, held captive by the education establishment, and that won't work. Everything is changing in America. Transportation education, healthcare, you name it. We need to make sure we have education change so that kids can read in Michigan.
Well, back to this literacy issue. Governor Rick Snyder, as you know, pushed for more funding and got more funding for early childhood education, free preschool. Will we start to see results of that in third grade literacy after this school year's MSTEP test, or is that wasted money?
You know, I think that we need to be very aggressive on this whole pre-K issue, and that's why these reading camps are important, summer reading camps as well, because this has to be a 365-day a year program in terms of reading. So the emphasis of Governor Snyder on pre-K, I think, is laudable. And what we need to do is really make sure that first, parents are in charge, giving parents choices and options. Now, I support options and choices and charters for parents. But the current approach is getting an F, and it means that we're failing children. That has to change. We just can't keep doing the same old approach. I went to public school. So did my wife, and so did our kids. But too many children are trapped in failing schools.
Let's talk about that, though. Why has this happened? Why have we seen 15 years of decline of scores by school children in Michigan?
You know, I think part of that is that we're changing the goalposts all the time. If you have this imagery in your head, Lester, about a football field, and if you're always changing the goalposts, meaning the test changes all the time, we have to have some consistency in our testing approach. You can't always be changing it all the time. And then secondly, we have to have renewed emphasis and determination on these reading coaches, reading camps. It means that our other states are doing better than we are, and that means we've got to win.
Bill Schuette is the Republican candidate for governor. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you, Lester.
We've extended offers to Democratic candidate Gretchen Whitmer and Libertarian candidate Bill Gelinow to discuss what they'd do to address Michigan's literacy rate. We hope to have those interviews for you next week. You're listening to Stateside. We will hear the Queen of Soul's funeral next. Stay with us. It's time to hit the road to visit another artisan of Michigan. This time we meet a few of them in Caledonia near Grand Rapids. This shop is Fiddler Furniture Company, headed up by Stephen Mark Fiddler.
We do primarily custom metalwork. We do some woodwork where we have exotic woods that we mix with our metalwork. Sometimes people want a table and they want a wood top but a metal base, and we can do both of those.
Fiddler does a lot of different kind of metalwork. Some of it is art, but the bulk of it is beautiful and functional. But getting into this work was not a direct line.
Sometimes, you know, you have your mind of what you think your career is going to be and what you're going to do, and it just kind of changes, and that's kind of what happened with me. People one day said, "You do metalwork? Can you make this hood?" Well, being bold and confident, I said, "Yeah, sure." And so we made one, and then we made another one. And people hear that we would do these hoods, and now everybody. I have people that send me a national magazine ad, and they say, "Can you make a hood like this?" And I'm cracking up. And they say, "Are you crazy?" I said, "I made that hood. It's, you know, in a national magazine." So, and we do a lot of stainless steel counters. And that's kind of fun because we do them in homes. We do them in restaurants. We do bar tops in big bars, and so we get to meet with people, and you know, you go in there and everybody says, "Hey, this is the guy that made this bar top. Oh, this is really cool." And you know, it's just, it's fun.
Now, about your cooking hoods, don't you buy those at Lowe's or the big Hobart kitchen appliance place or something like that?
No, we make those from scratch. Our customers will sit down with us and they want the straps from this style of a hood, they want the shape of that style of hood, and so we can really help them because we take several different concepts and put them together to get their dream hood.
How'd you get started in this business?
Well, I worked for Hobart Food Equipment, so my background was some stainless work, and I had an opportunity to be a partner in a company that made commercial kitchen equipment. And then I come up with this idea, I was going to make stainless steel tables, occasional tables. And I went to interior designers and I said, "Look at these, in this new line of tables we have." And they said, "Well, do you make countertops?" "Yeah, I've made those for years, but look at these beautiful tables." They didn't want the tables. They wanted countertops and cooking hoods and other stuff. So Yeah, we make them with a lot of different materials, and we have a lot of different finishes. We do some patina finishes where you take chemicals and put it on the metal to change the color of the metal and change the texture of it. And we, you know, mirror polish stainless and brass and bronze and copper and painted wood to come up with a look, a different look that a customer might want.
If you've spent any time in downtown Grand Rapids, you've probably seen Fiddler's Furniture.
Amway Grand Plaza Hotel, JW Marriott, Reserve Wine Bar.
Ferrari in Detroit now.
Ferrari in Detroit. If you go in downtown Grand Rapids and go in and out of restaurants and bars, you'll see tons of our stuff. Everybody says you should put your name on it, but when we do it with, you know, private people and that, I don't know if they want my name on it or not, so we don't put our name on it. Haven't yet.
When I got to Fiddler Furniture, I was also shown some exhibits of side projects by the people who work there. For example, Anthony Amalfitano's lamps made of copper tubing and Edison bulbs were on display.
I just thought it was kind of neat, and it doesn't take a lot of tools to put it together that way, so just a little bit of creativity at home, I guess.
Walt Gerdak had a sleek sort of moped sitting on the table.
It's more of a 60s, 50cc racer style. You didn't see too many of them in the United States. They were more European.
And then there was some work by a guy who Fiddler tells me has quite a following, J. Prosh Jensen.
I do metal art, been doing that about 5-6 years now. Mostly recycled, mostly found object type of thing is what I do. And yeah, it's very nice that Steve embraces it the way he does and lets me work out of his shop and use some of his tools and even his scraps. So, yeah.
Fiddler says this is all about fostering creativity and keeping good people on staff.
We hire artisans and artists. Like everybody here, they do artwork in their spare time and even after hours. I enjoy giving other artists the opportunity to use the shop. I mean, we have a huge investment here for making artwork and stuff, and most artists don't have a great big press and big shears that they can use.
And Fiddler says it's also about keeping the work interesting.
I feel like I'm doing a weekend fun hobby every day. Every day feels like a Saturday to me. I love what I do.
Is it the design work or the hands-on stuff that you like best?
Both. I do a lot of the design work. We do have an engineer that helps with all the technical aspect of everything, but I like meeting with customers and coming up with concepts. I do work in the shop a lot. It's hard to stay out here. I like coming in on weekends even.
Stephen Mark Fiddler of the Fiddler Furniture Company. He's our latest Artisan of Michigan. This is Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Clark sisters, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, Smokey Robinson, were just a few, just part of Aretha Franklin's funeral at Grace Emanuel Baptist Church in Detroit today. Here's a little bit of a sample of that.
I want to hear from Motown tonight. Let's salute the queen tonight.
Here's my living in vain.
Our beautiful waterfront jewel will be Aretha Franklin Park.
I'll miss you, my friend. I know that my love for you will never end, and I'm gonna love you forever.
We'll listen to a bit more of the funeral at the end of the program. Past research has indicated where you live could affect your health, but how do you measure the factors that contribute to that effect? How would you measure whether your neighborhood is in better or worse shape at helping you to be or stay healthy? Rick Sadler has tackled that question. He's an assistant professor of public health and an urban geographer at Michigan State University's College of Human Medicine's Flint campus. He was the lead author of a study published in the journal Social Science and Medicine, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Howdy, how you doing?
It's fine. So how would you go about measuring how your neighborhood affects your health?
Yeah, we know that individual characteristics like access to healthy foods have some relationship to health and health behaviors, but we didn't know how all kinds of different variables rolled together. And so we used this process called the analytic hierarchy process, and we consulted experts on the subject and asked them to tell us what they thought would be most important in predicting health and health behaviors. And then we threw it all in a what they call map algebra and basically added them all of these map-based variables together, and we came up with an index that we think predicts health and health behaviors.
Now, you did a big survey among academic and community leaders in Flint. Who do you pick for something like that?
Yeah, so everybody that participated is a member of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions, and that's an NIH-funded center grant that we're working on here. And so those included academic partners as well as partners from our community consortium.
What kind of things were they asked to score?
Things like access to healthy foods, exposure to crime, exposure to industrial contamination, proximity to doctor's offices, parks. So both good and bad things.
How do you determine whether one factor or another has more impact on health?
So in this case, they basically, it was like a round-robin sports tournament. So all of the variables competed against one another. And so you would ask yourself, you know, what's more important, you know, in predicting good mental health and, you know, preventing substance abuse? You know, exposure to heroin overdoses or crime or blight, like which of those are most important?
What'd you find?
So what we found, it was probably not unexpected, but a little dismaying, that there was a lot of variation from neighborhood to neighborhood.
Well, I don't mean so much that, just how do you indicate how significant some of these factors are?
That's a good question. So it's all up to the expert. The experts were the ones that were rating how important these were. And so the only thing that we did on the map side is come up with basically the proximity to or the distance away from good or bad elements. And then the experts were really the ones that gave the weights to those variables.
Now, you created what you call a healthfulness index for each of the areas in the neighborhoods. What did you do with the information you gathered from that survey to create that?
Yeah, so once we had this information, really what we want to be able to do is both link it to the intervention studies that we're going to be doing over the next couple of years, and linking basically where people live and the healthfulness score in their neighborhood to their health behaviors and their health behavior change, so that we can answer whether neighborhood context really does influence someone's ability to change their behavior for the better. And what we also hope to be able to do is once we have a better grip on how this actually influences health, to advocate for changes to the built environment, specific like targeted changes in neighborhoods where we know, for instance, that you know it's a lot harder for people to make this health behavior change because of some negative characteristic of their neighborhood.
As we mentioned, past research has indicated where you live can affect your health, but how unique is your index?
As far as I could tell, I mean, anywhere I was looking, I couldn't find anything like this. And it's part of the reason that we decided to do this, because, you know, people will look at an individual characteristic like proximity to parks and see how that influences mental health or physical activity. But nobody's really thrown a bunch of variables together to see how they interact.
Now, you talked about this a little bit, but I'm wondering what can or should be done with this data? Where do you go from here, and where do you get policymakers involved?
Yeah, so like I was saying, you know, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be any variation in these scores. But because we saw so much neighborhood variation, you know, some neighborhoods have all kinds of amenities, and then other neighborhoods have very few. And, I mean, again, that's not news. But being able to highlight it in this index and being able to link it to the way people can actually affect behavior change is a better advocacy tool for policymakers, because we can say, look, neighborhoods that have, you know, XYZ negative characteristics, you know, people are 40% less likely to be able to be physically active. And so if we make these neighborhoods the way these other neighborhoods look, then we should see that same effect where, you know, people are more able to change their behaviors.
So if I'm looking at a literal map of Flint and see how you've rated these different neighborhoods, does a pattern emerge geographically?
A little bit, yeah. There's been a lot of new investment in downtown and kind of east and west of downtown, along the Flint River and out toward Mott Community College. And those neighborhoods score really well because there's a lot of amenities, you know, blight's being cleaned up, crime is lower in those places. Whereas older neighborhoods north of downtown and in the east side still are scoring a lot lower, and that's because they have so many of these challenges.
I assume that socioeconomics have a lot to do with that.
Yeah, for sure.
How about race?
You know, in Flint, I don't think there's not much of a pattern anymore. I mean, really what the inequality is, and it's the same with like with the water crisis, for instance, is that the suburbs of Flint are still overwhelmingly white, and the city of Flint is predominantly African American. And so when we talk about inequalities from city to suburb, that's where a lot of the issue comes in. But within the city, the variation in terms of healthfulness scores doesn't really reflect based on race.
So this research being in Flint, of course, Flint is still dealing with the aftermath of the lead contamination of the water. How can this help Flint residents in particular?
Yeah, I think it's an advocacy tool. It's another piece of evidence that, you know, community partners can use in, for instance, grant applications to say, look, our neighborhood is lagging behind in these indicators, and we want to do something about it. So can you help us out?
Rick Sadler is an assistant professor of public health at Michigan State University working at the Flint campus of the College of Human Medicine. He was the lead author of a study published in the journal Social Science and Medicine, reinforcing research that indicates where you live can affect your health. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Next week, the Michigan legislature is in session, and the Republican leaders are talking about adopting a couple of the citizen initiatives headed for the ballot in November. Joining me to talk about that are Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader, and Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. So those two proposals are a phased-in $12 minimum wage and paid sick leave. Ken, generally speaking, the Republicans oppose those two proposals. Why would they adopt them?
Well, these are citizen-initiated laws. So after you get the right number of signatures, they go to the legislature. The legislature has a certain amount of time to either adopt them or ignore it or put an alternative on the ballot. The issue here is that should they be adopted by the voters, amending it later is virtually impossible. It takes a three-quarters vote of the legislature to do it. And the argument from Republicans, let's for a moment just kind of put aside the partisan issue, but the argument is legislation like this shouldn't be legislated at the ballot box because of the difficulty of changing it later. I've got sympathy for that argument, but not necessarily specific to these two issues, minimum wage and paid sick time. I just, generally speaking, have never liked legislating at the ballot. But the argument they're making is let's adopt it potentially right now, and then we can amend it with a simple majority vote. Of course, it takes a governor's signature to do it. And that's the sort of philosophical and ideological and policy-oriented argument here.
But there's also political strategy.
No question about it. And the political sort of motivation becomes suspect in an election year where you would argue that these proposals, by being on the ballot, will increase Democratic turnout, and Republicans are already facing headwinds. So you're doing this, and you're having this discussion in an intensely political environment, but it kind of is what it is.
Vicki, I want to ask you about the fact that the legislature is talking about adopting them. But first, I want to ask you, if part of this is to give Democrats less incentive to go vote, how well do you think that strategy would work?
I think it would continue to anger voters. The reason why we have the ability to put legislation on the ballot for the voters to vote on is because we have a government by and for the people. The legislature has been looking at an introduction of bills for paid sick leave for the last several years and has failed to act on it. The public finds this to be appalling, at least the hundreds of thousands of people who sign these petitions, and have decided that since the legislature won't act, the people should. And that's the logic behind voter-driven initiatives. If we look at what the legislature is not taking up and what the people want to get done, these two particular bills make a lot of sense. And so while you can say they're being put on the ballot to drive Democratic turnout, they're put on the ballot to address the needs of the people that the legislature, elected by them, refuses to deal with. So if the legislature wants to play these games, and they've played them before, the people will continue to put things on the ballot and get more and more incensed. I want to go back to the emergency manager law for just a minute. The emergency manager law was beefed up in 2011 after Governor Snyder took office and was put into effect, and the voters didn't like it. And the voters went to the polls, and they wanted to repeal that law. And they successfully repealed it in 2012, only to have a legislature refuse to listen to the people and turn around in 2013 and pass a slightly modified version of the same bill, thereby eliminating the voice of the people who went to the polls and who paid for this petition drive. So I think the people would see this the same way.
Let me ask you both something. At this point, there are people working for minimum wage in Michigan, which is higher than the federal minimum wage, we should say. But it costs taxpayers because the business isn't paying them enough to support their families. And if the minimum wage were increased, wouldn't that mean fewer people would have to be subsidized by taxpayer-supported welfare programs? Isn't that the goal of lawmakers, both Republican and Democrat, Ken?
Well, but there's a lot of studies that suggest if you raise the minimum wage, people at the lower end of the economic scale get laid off because small businesses can't afford it. And you got competing studies whether or not it helps low-income people or it hurts low-income people. But here's one of the issues with this particular proposal. It eliminates something called the tip credit. And I would argue you shouldn't do that because by eliminating this sort of complicated tip credit mechanism, you potentially lower wages for people that thrive on tips, waiters and waitresses, and do well, and you increase labor costs for restaurant employers. But that's just an example of why I think it's a bad idea to be doing these things at the ballot box.
Vicki?
Well, again, I think when citizens keep requesting that the legislature act on certain issues to give them relief or help or assistance, and the legislature fails, they're not doing the people's business. So the people take it upon themselves to pass petitions around to put these things on the ballot for a vote. When it comes to minimum wage, I have a very different view from the Republican philosophy. I don't think businesses are job creators. I think people with extra money to spend and disposable income create jobs by spending money and therefore driving up demand for goods and services, forcing businesses to hire people to keep up with that demand. So I think that it is a shame that we have people working full time in this state, making only $18,000 a year and trying to raise a family on that. And that's what we're talking about with the minimum wage at $9 and a quarter. So I think if you work full time, you should be able to pay your bills, take care of your family, and not be on government assistance. So I am one of those that believe that we should raise the minimum wage. However, Ken is right. In this one, it's a little more complicated because it also raises the wages of restaurant workers, which have a different minimum wage scale at this time. And some restaurant workers like that, and others really hate it because it may drive down their overall income. I don't know what the answer is, but certainly we need to do something to break up the growing income inequality in this country, which is really hurting people at the low end of the economic scale.
Let me talk about a different topic altogether. A really interesting thing that's happened is this voting rights group that's connected with a big Democratic super PAC is asking clerks and election officials all across the state for copies of every ballot, every provisional ballot, the ballot and envelope of absentee ballots that were mailed in. Ken, what's going on here?
Well, it's a little hard to say. This group that has made a request under the Freedom of Information Act for all of these ballots and related information up to this point has been somewhat secret. There's some delicious irony, I guess, in asking for public information but not being transparent about who you are. But if it's a legitimate research request that wants to look at the integrity of the Michigan electoral system, so be it. It doesn't come at a very good time for the clerks. You know, they're busy getting ready for the November election. But I would argue that if the group's willing to be transparent, disclose exactly who they are, and they want it for research purposes, maybe after the election, all these clerks can comply with it. But it takes a lot of effort and costs a lot of money, and the group's going to have to pay for it.
Vicki, the Detroit News reports this group is really kind of unnerved county clerks who are trying to prepare for the elections. Who's the money behind this, and what do they want?
Well, the money behind it is Priorities USA Foundation, and they're examining access to the polls across the country, supposedly. So let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. Why they went to a third party and hid behind the name Emily, I don't know, and I think that's kind of suspect. And if I were a clerk and all of a sudden received a massive FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, for voter data information, absentee ballot envelopes, and signatures, and I don't know who this Emily is, I would equally be concerned. If this is truly for legitimate research purposes, then the FOIA request should go ahead after the November election so that clerks aren't torn between managing the current election cycle and dealing with a massive FOIA request. So on that, I totally agree with Ken. If there's a legitimate reason to do the research on this, then they should work out a deal and a compromise to get all this data after the election. But again, it's going to be very, very expensive. Priorities USA is going to have to come up with the money to put this together.
Yeah, and with FOIA costs in this state, since they're very, very high often, that could be millions of dollars, it looks like. That is Vicki Barnett. She's a former Democratic legislator. We also heard from Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Hey, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Please stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. You might remember back in January, there were several sightings of a fireball in the sky over southeast Michigan. There was a buzz about it on the internet, video was posted, and the following day, Michigan Radio reported that the United States Geological Survey confirmed it was a meteoroid which exploded in the atmosphere about 15 miles above ground. At the time, the boom it caused was reported to register 2.0 on the Richter scale, which measures the magnitude of earthquakes. For the USGS and NASA, the event was not that big of a deal. But it turns out all of this happened over a bunch of sensors, including cameras, seismometers, infrared microphones, which gave scientists a lot more information than they would normally get. Joining us now is Jeroen Ritsema. He's a seismologist and professor of earth and environmental sciences at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Did you actually hear the boom yourself or see that flash that night?
No, I did not. I did not hear or see it. I heard it on the news. And the next morning when I came in, I saw the seismic recording here in Ann Arbor. And that actually caught my attention. And that's how I got into looking for other data in Michigan and in Ohio to see if that burst was seismically recorded further than just Ann Arbor.
So what kind of data did you get from this concentration of sensors?
Well, we got from these data basically three pieces of observation. We had a really good recording of the ground motion that we saw in seismometer data. We had direct recording of sound from infrasound recordings. And then we had from a satellite, we had visible light. So we can actually pinpoint exactly where the burst of the meteorite happened in Michigan.
That seismic activity that you've recorded, was that due just because of the sound of the explosion shaking the ground?
Yes, that's correct. The sound of the explosion propagates through the atmosphere and it perturbs the ground a little bit. And that's enough for us to see on seismometers that are buried within the ground.
How rare is it to get this much data from one minor meteoroid?
It's pretty rare. My colleague Michael Hedlund from the University of California, San Diego, has analyzed similar events, I think in 2004, in 2010. So maybe once in a decade, once in 5 years, we record something like this. Actually, the biggest event that we ever recorded was in 2013, a big explosion over Russia.
Right.
That was actually recorded pretty much worldwide on seismometers and infrasound.
So what did the data tell you about this particular meteoroid? What do we know about it?
What we learned from this particular meteorite is that it exploded pretty much around 12, 13 miles in the atmosphere. We learned from the satellite data that it came in fairly steep, at a fairly steep angle, roughly 30,000 miles per hour, about 30 degrees from vertical. And it exploded pretty much above Hamburg, where most of the meteorite fragments were found. But also exactly the data from the satellite and the data from the seismic recordings were pretty much in agreement of where it was within a mile or so.
Here's a question I have. You know, when we see Hollywood's versions of something coming in, it kind of breaks apart. But we had this big boom. Was this a sonic boom? Was this the thing exploding? Tell me what that boom was from.
The boom that you probably heard is the sonic boom, because this rock comes in much, much faster than the speed of sound. So it generates a sonic boom, very much like what jet fighters might do when they fly over much faster than the speed of sound. But what we recorded seismically was really the burst, was really the terminal burst, the explosion of the meteor.
How difficult was to gather all this different data together and make it something useful that you can understand? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of cross-referencing necessary to make sense of it all.
Yes, well, we were very lucky because this meteor propagated over Michigan, and we just happened to have a set of sensors that just happened to be deployed in eastern North America by IRIS, which is an organization that deploys seismic instrumentation around the world, but also in the United States. So we were lucky to have 160 infrasound sensors, more than 10 seismic stations, and then the satellite data recording that same event by all three measures.
And these instruments were there for another purpose?
Yeah, the seismic instrumentations are there really for a different purpose. In the last 10 years, the IRIS organization has deployed seismic instruments that have moved from the West Coast to the East Coast. And those are mostly intended to study the North American crust and the North American plate to understand geological processes in the region.
How useful is this data collected? I mean, how will it be used? What will it tell us about things to look for in the future?
Well, things that one could use these data for is understanding the frequencies of these smaller meteorite explosions. We have some idea of how often they might occur. It's something on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 times per year. But we have to be lucky enough to record them with all these instrumentations that we have. So we get a better sense of the frequency of these events. Something else you can do, since we have a very good idea of where this particular meteorite burst, we have a very good pinpoint of the location of the burst, we could then use the recorded sound to actually understand the physics of sound propagation through the atmosphere. And that propagation depends a lot on the temperature structure of the atmosphere. It depends on the wind conditions in the atmosphere. So something like this can be used to study the temperature and wind conditions in the upper atmosphere, where it's very difficult to collect data.
Now, you're a seismologist. I assume that messing around with meteors or meteoroids, just not your school of thought most of the time.
No, that's right. This was a funny distraction for me for a couple of months. But normally I look at structures maybe 1,000 to 2,000 miles deep in the Earth's interior.
And so not 15 miles up. Yeah.
Right. I never look up. I usually look down. That's correct.
Jeroen Ritsema is a seismologist and professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Michigan. We've been talking about the small meteoroid which flashed across the sky in southeast Michigan back in January and the data that were gathered from that event. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Eight deans at Michigan State University jointly signed their names to a piece recently published in Inside Higher Ed. In it, they say they are compelled to, quote, confront the power dynamics that can make academe a haven for predatory behavior and abuse. Joining us now are two of those deans. Cheryl Sisk is interim dean for the College of Natural Sciences. Christopher Long is dean of the College of Arts and Letters. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
So for those of you who have been following this story, Michigan State University sports doctor Larry Nassar has been convicted after about 300 women said that Nassar had sexually abused them under the guise of treatment. This went on for a couple of decades. Michigan State staff and administrators did not believe complaints and did not do what was necessary to stop Nassar. So given that, you have written that we need to deal with that reality. What do you plan to do to confront the power that allowed that?
So we've been focused as deans in the wake of the survivor impact statements, which have really transformed the culture here at MSU and the power of the women who have spoken so courageously have been really an inspiration for us as deans to take a hard look at all of the aspects of the culture of MSU, to begin to have the kinds of conversations that will ensure that when people speak up, they're listened to, and that we can redress issues as they emerge.
One of the points you made that you have to avoid the temptation to put the Nassar crisis behind us. Why is that important?
It's so important because if you weren't at MSU in mid to late January, it's just hard to imagine the impact that listening to those survivor statements had on us as individuals and as a community. It was so powerful. For me personally, I went through just a period of grieving and the various stages of grief of, you know, denial and then anger and sorrow. And it was just such an emotional experience. And just watching the courage and the determination of those girls and women who did just have the courage and the guts to come forward and tell their stories, that was so overwhelming and influential. There is no way I'm putting that in my rearview mirror. That is my inspiration and my motivation to make MSU a better place. And so they're forefront in my mind.
You, the deans who wrote this, say basically higher ed is called to seek the truth, tell the truth, hear the truth, critical self-reflection, accountability. Yet at institution after institution, we know of cases where those standards are pushed aside either in a crisis, a PR crisis sometimes, or to protect favored personnel. So why is that happening in these institutions that know better?
Yeah, that's an issue we tried to address in the second of the three imperatives we outlined in the essay. These structural issues that are really driving certain kinds of behavior that have to be redressed. So often we are in higher education, and I think in other industries as well, driven by certain metrics of success. And often that causes us to lose sight of the core values that drive us as institutions. In higher education, those metrics often concern, you know, research dollars or rankings in various areas. And sometimes those rankings cause us to lose sight of the core values of the mission of the university. We at MSU, for example, are a land-grant university, and we're a focus on access. And when, for example, one of the main things that the rankings look at is selectivity, you know, if we're driven by that, we are in a certain sense in conflict with our own core values of a university. So we're really focused on the issues of accountability that we articulated in the essay, and holding each other accountable, not just in the policies we establish and the way in which we insist upon compliance, but also in our daily interactions with one another to ensure that we're creating a culture that is safe and caring and supportive.
But those measurements, things such as raising money and elevating national rankings, they are seen as measurements of success by administrators and a lot of faculty, too. So how do you get past that?
Yeah, it's true. That's reality. The problem comes when those trying to achieve those metrics and being, you know, at the top of the heap, when those become your primary motivation for an institution. And it, as Chris said, makes you lose sight of what you're really supposed to be doing. That's, you know, that's when it becomes the tail wagging the dog. And that's what we're trying not to lose sight of.
In that part of the essay in Inside Higher Ed, it also notes that, quote, many other unjust and inequitable campus structures and processes must be interrogated and redressed. What do you mean by that?
For example, there are plenty of behaviors that people engage in that don't rise to the level of criminal behavior or even, you know, something that requires disciplinary action. But they're behaviors that we don't want to tolerate and enable at Michigan State. Things like bullying, things like abuse of someone's power. Academia, like every other segment of society, there are inherent power structures, and the power dynamics, when they come into play, can go wrong and can lead to behaviors that we simply do not want to tolerate. So may have nothing to do with sexual harassment or sexual misconduct or research misconduct, nothing like that. These are just how we treat people as human beings.
You're talking about civility, it sounds like.
Civility.
Exactly. And I think one of the issues that we're really focused on are issues of structural inequity, and that can involve issues around gender or issues around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's been a huge focus of ours among the deans, is to emphasize the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and to recognize the ways that institutions have privileged certain kinds of ways of knowing. And we need to open up spaces for more innovative, intersectional ways of knowing and modes of research. That's an imperative that we have as academic institutions. So driving at metrics that measure the same old forms of scholarship and old ways of knowing is inherently regressive.
Well, you talk about that in your conclusion, a goal of creating more trust and equity, and you call on everyone in higher ed to hold one another accountable, from staff to the governing board, from students to the faculty, all across levels of administration. What would that look like on a day-to-day basis?
That's exactly the discussion that are happening all over campus. So back at the first of the year, the deans met weekly, if not more than that, to talk about that very issue. What does this look like in the workplace? And so what we've been doing or trying to do is simply lead by example. And so among the deans, we've had conversations about what are our shared values. How do we want to treat each other? What are our expectations of each other? How are we as deans going to hold ourselves accountable? So we've had those discussions at our level. We created white papers and other kinds of things that put those ideas on paper. And then as academic leaders, we are trying to help others in our own colleges to have those exact same conversations. This is going to be the kind of thing that has to happen from the ground up. You know, the provost or the dean can't dictate to students, faculty, and staff what their values should be and how they should behave. This has got to be something that is a very local conversation, and that's what we're trying to help everybody at MSU start to do and think about.
One of the things that's been really heartening about working with the deans, and Cheryl's been a leader on this, is the way in which we are giving each other courage to have the hard conversations we need to have. We've had a series of meetings around community values and trying to discern ways to empower units to have conversations about, well, what are their expectations of one another with respect to professional behavior? How are we holding each other accountable in those contexts? And what's been exciting about the meetings that Cheryl has led has been that we're having conversations across the levels of the institution, deans with associate deans, with associate provosts, with members, chairs of departments.
Well, let me stop you, because this is important, I think. Is it happening above your level?
Yes, I think we are working, you know, across the university to ensure that these values are embodied in everything we do. And that's been our commitment as deans. We said we wanted to create a culture that's transparent, open, trusting, and safe, that facilitates accountability and care, and that is equitable and inclusive. And those are the values that we are bringing to our interactions every day.
We've been talking to Chris Long, Dean of College of Arts and Letters, and Cheryl Sisk, Interim Dean for the College of Natural Sciences at Michigan State University. They, along with six other deans at Michigan State, assigned onto a piece titled "Can Michigan State Recover and Chart a New Path for Higher Education?" It was published last month in Inside Higher Ed. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it.
Let's end the show today by turning back to Aretha Franklin's funeral service at Greater Grace Temple in Detroit, not Grace Emanuel, as I said earlier in the program. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening to Stateside.